Hello, and welcome to Color Me Healthy, a production of the Community Health Center of Buffalo. Color Me Healthy focuses on wellness for communities of color and how we can all develop a better quality of life. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by Community Health Center employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the Community Health Center or any of its officials. This program is meant to be used for general informational purposes only. While this program provides information on such topics as health and wellness, the subject matter discussed is not intended to be a substitute for seeking care and service from a health professional. In all instances, even where a guest is a licensed physician, listeners should not view the opinions and perspectives expressed on the program as medical advice. Listeners are also encouraged to pay attention to the credentials and professional qualifications of the program's guests. In instances where a guest is not a licensed medical professional, listeners should note that the guest is not legally authorized to practice medicine in any setting. Listeners are always encouraged to consult with their own personal health care professional.
Hello, I'm your host, Carl Schallhorn, Education Program Coordinator at the Community Health Center of Buffalo. Thank you for joining us. In this episode of Color Me Healthy, we're presenting the second half of our conversation on addiction with Chris Thrasher. Chris is the Senior Director of Substance Use Disorders and Recovery at the Clinton Foundation. We're joining this discussion in progress. So let's talk, you mentioned a little bit before about jails being the new mental health and addiction treatment providers, if you want to call that, centers. There's been a huge shift over the years. And of course, there's a lot of issues around criminalization for drugs. What do you think is maybe an approach that we should be taking, especially now with like the advent of the legalization of marijuana, for instance? That's really seems to be one of the things that all kinds of people are talking about. Right now in New York State, there's even some legislation being proposed to legalize marijuana. How do you see this type of, I guess you call it like a paradigm shift, a shift in people's thinking around substances as far as the long term when it comes to dealing with addiction?
Well, you know, listen, in order to really answer that question, we have to understand the numbers, right? So right now in our country, we have about 20 million people living with a substance use disorder. Of those 20 million people, only 10% of them are going to get the treatment that they need, leaving a 90% treatment gap. When we look at addiction as a criminal activity versus a disease, it's very easy to go to the place of just lock them up with no treatment, no access to treatment at that point. So how do we change that? Well, you know, look at the 90% treatment gap that we have. And we have a law now on the books with, you know, addiction equity that says that addiction will be treated and covered the same way any other chronic illness is treated and covered in our country. Mm-hmm. If you are listening to this and you have run into a roadblock and you are pulling your hair out because you can't get your loved one the treatment that they need, I encourage you to go to the site parityregistry.org, O-R-G, parityregistry, all one word, .org. That's a site that Patrick Kennedy, Congressman Patrick Kennedy, put together. And it's a website that allows people to come and use that site to tell their story, to be able to share their experience and get the resources and the help that they need to ensure that their loved one gets the treatment that they're seeking.
Right.
Right. So parityregistry.org is a great site, but we need more places like that that people can go, because trying to navigate this healthcare system is a nightmare.
Right.
It's the most difficult, challenging things. I know this. I have a daughter with type 1 diabetes, and to get her the insulin pump that she needed, I was denied 3 times from my provider. Now, I didn't give up. I ended up having to write a letter to my state insurance commissioner. Wow. When I wrote the letter to my insurance commissioner, 2 weeks later, she was approved for the pump.
Wow.
There's no reason why someone who is diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at age 6, that the dad should be fighting for an insulin pump that maintains her sugar much more effectively than anything we could do manually with a meter.
Wow.
But I had to literally go to my insurance commissioner And then I got a call from my insurance company that said, oh, you know, we've approved your request. And I said, oh, did it have anything to do with the letter that I wrote to the insurance company? No. We didn't even know about that. We just have, you know, laxed up on our requirements. So we're happy to say that we've approved the pump. Now, you and I, Carl, know that that was probably not true.
Right.
That in fact, you know, they don't like hearing. They certainly don't like. There used to be a commercial in Buffalo, and I forgot the store that it was for, but it was a clothing store, and they said, an educated consumer
Sims.
Is our best.
Size Sims.
Yeah, an educated consumer is our best customer. And I think that is true for healthcare. An educated consumer is the best customer. You need to educate yourself and understand the law, because the law is here to protect and serve all of us.
I love how you say that. So let's break it down for our listeners. So if they have these kind of questions, what are some of the other resources? What are some of the tools that our listeners can use for themselves, for their loved ones, that can help them navigate this very broken system?
Well, you know, in each community that we talk to, the rule that we use is that if you spoke to one community, you've spoke to one community. So there is no cookie cutter approach, Carl, that can be used. I think that, you know, I would just reiterate educating yourself. How do you do that? I mean, now today we have, you know, the internet. If you don't have access to the internet, and many, you know, communities and households still don't, go to the public library, you know, join your public library. There is access to the internet there, but begin to do the research yourself. And it's as simple as literally Googling. And just learning what's out there. The reason why I gave you parityregistry.org as a site is because it is a site that can absolutely begin to educate you on the law and how to ensure that loved ones that you are, you know, working with or trying to get help for can get the help that they need.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to your own passion in this work, how has that helped to fuel you? I mean, obviously, we're talking about work that is oftentimes, even speaking from my own experience, working in the mental health and addiction field, feels like you're fighting an uphill battle. You know, like every day you wake up, it's like there's more to do, there's more to accomplish, more than needs to be done. What keeps you going? Like, what fuels your fire when it comes to this kind of work?
Well, I mean, you know, I shared with you some of the doom and gloom, but the upside of that is that there are 23 plus million people living in long-term recovery, you know? So we have hope. What keeps me going is in fact hope. You know, many years ago, I decided to put pen to paper around hope, because hope is thrown around as if there's a universal definition for it. I remember when President Obama was campaigning before he became president, and he talked about, you know, hope, and he got these crowds riled up around hope. And I thought to myself, what does hope really mean? Because I go to my own meetings as part of a 12-step fellowship, and hope is talked about almost at every meeting I go to. Mm-hmm. And so I decided, you know, what does hope mean for me? So I thought about it. And I spent some time, and I put pen to paper, and I created HOPE as an acronym. And the H, I decided, stood for health. And when I think about health, I think about mental health, physical health, spiritual health, emotional health, and sexual health. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of health.
Yeah.
But when we talk about total health and well-being, I mean, we don't like to talk about sexual health in this country.
Right.
You know, we don't want to talk about mental health in this country. So total health and well-being includes mental health, spiritual health, emotional health, physical health, sexual health, but it's all aspects of health. I mean, I go to meetings, Carl, 12-step meetings, and out in front of the meeting, there's a group of folks that are consuming copious amounts of nicotine and caffeine. Mm-hmm. And they go into these meetings, you know, talking about spiritual principles. But yet, you know, too many of us in recovery are overweight. Too many of us in recovery are hopelessly addicted to caffeine and nicotine, mm-hmm. and don't understand the relationship that nicotine has to opioid receptors in our brain and how that all works and how they actually make, you know, their experience in recovery more difficult. So the H is for health. The O for me means opportunities. So I think, you know, as a person of color, I've been given incredible opportunities to, once I became a person in long-term recovery, to really pursue my dreams. But opportunities were abound. I mean, I had opportunities to go back to school. When I got into recovery, Carl, I was a ninth grade high school dropout, right? So the idea of me even getting a GED was beyond my wildest dreams, right? So opportunities is the O. The P is power. And that can be higher power, or that can be to empower myself, you know? One of the things that I have to remind myself often is that, you know, we talk about self-help programs. Mm-hmm. A self-help program is just that. It's self-help.
Right.
You know, you can't work my program for me. As much as I would like for that to happen, because as someone in long-term recovery, and I will just say, I find myself sometimes looking for the shorter, easier, softer way. But the truth is that, you know, my grandma used to tell me, Chris, God will move mountains for you, but you have to bring the shovel,
I like that.
And so the P is to empower myself, or to have faith in a higher power that reminds me that I can do anything that I set my mind to. You know, if you would have told me 25 years ago that I'd be working for a former president of the United States, advancing efforts in this country around substance use disorders and recovery, I would have thought that's crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just insane. And so the P is power, and the E, the final E on hope, is for education. Now, education, I'm not necessarily talking about the kind that I was fortunate enough to get in the ivory towers. You know, I went on after my GED, and I went on for a four-year degree, a bachelor's degree, and went on for a master's degree at NYU, and I went on even for a doctorate. You know, to study and have that education is great. But so much of the education that I've gotten is just out in the community,
mm-hmm.
you know, going to 12-step meetings and listening to people share their lived experiences and learning how to be able to find a language. Taking you back now, remember how I said the preachers lacked a language from the pulpit?
Right.
You know, but learning a language, how to effectively talk about substance use disorders. I mean, look at, you know, just to give you another stat that's so troubling, 40% of people with substance use disorders have what's called a co-occurring disorder.
Right.
So they struggle with a mental illness and a substance use disorder, right? Now, I would tell you that 40% is way underestimated. If you were to ask me anecdotally, I would tell you that 100% of people with a substance use disorder has a co-occurring right. mental illness.
Right.
Whether it's depression, anxiety, whatever it is, you know, the people that I talk to over these last, I have 29 years in recovery, will tell you that they were treating their depression. They were self-medicating their mental illness. But because mental illness has such a stigma, no one wants to talk about it, especially communities of color. The way that people talk about mental illness varies from culture to culture, from community to community. People of color, actually, I'll tell you a story. There was a gentleman who went to the hospital because he was a over-the-road, long-haul truck driver, and he was an African-American man. And he went and talked to his doctor about, he said, you know, when I'm driving down the road, I have this thing on my shoulder, like he's like the devil, and it's the voice, and he talks to me, and he tells me all these evil, terrible things about myself and things to do to people. And I can't seem to get that voice out of my head. Well, you know, the doctor diagnosed him with schizophrenia.
Hmm.
For African Americans, sometimes we lack the language to adequately describe the feelings that we're having. So we do the best we can. The gentleman in the story was actually suffering from just depression and anxiety. And he was trying to tell, you know, the provider that he was, you know, having these voices that were just making him depressed,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't schizophrenia.
Right.
You know, so the way that we describe our feelings really does change from culture to culture. And we need providers who are competent in understanding how different cultures explain different ailments. That is so, so, so important. At Morehouse School of Medicine, we had a crash course on cultural competency where we, as part of the training, we trained providers as to how to recognize how different cultures describe the challenges that they're having around their own health.
Yeah. You know, I just have to give a plug for the Community Health Center here in Buffalo. We do a lot of that. We have providers from different cultures. We have providers that speak the language, that can relate to our community that we serve. So you're absolutely right. Having that relatability is so very important for people who are going to seek help that they can get it. So I guess, Chris, in means of just wrapping things up, first of all, I want to say thank you for being here. This is a wonderful opportunity to hear from yourself, someone who has both, like you said, the professional experience, the personal lived experience, and has used both those things really to not only obviously help yourself, but help others. And that's really what we're talking about here is, you know, you've been able to help a lot of people through the work that you do over your career. So we've kind of developing this tradition here on this program where we ask our guests to use one word to describe the work that you do in terms of what it is. So if you had to use one word to describe your work, what would it be?
Well, that's easy, and I just gave you the acronym. It would be HOPE. You know, but it's not just HOPE, you know, generically.
Right.
I mean, I really did kind of define it as I see it in my life and how it works for me in my life. I want to go back for 1 second because there may be someone who listened to what I just said earlier about cultural competency and wonders what that crash course really is. I want to, and CRASH is an actual acronym, and I want to run through that because I think it's super important. The C is for culture, to understand one's culture. The R is for respect. So respecting that I might not know your culture, but being willing to do the A, which is assessment or affirmation, right? So if we don't know, we ask, okay? We assess and we affirm. The S is for sensitivity and self-awareness. So we have to recognize our limits. We have to recognize that we don't know all, right? And the H is to do it all with humility. Mm. You know, listen, I don't have all the answers, but what I do know is that we have a huge, huge problem in this nation, but it's not insurmountable, right? There's a reason why we make up 5% of the world's population, but take up 80% of the world's opioids prescribed. That's a huge, huge problem. To give you to put that into like a number that you might be able to wrap your head around. In Arkansas, Little Rock, where President Clinton is from, we're working with faith leaders there, and in Arkansas, the population is roughly 3 million people across the whole state. Last year, 236 million opioids were prescribed.
Wow.
To a population of 3 million.
Wow.
Now, if you do the math, that's about 78 or 79 opioids per every man, woman, and child in this country. So we have a lot of work to do, and it's going to take all of us working together. It's going to literally take all of us working together and hanging on to the hope that I talked about.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Chris, for being here. Chris Thrasher from the Clinton Foundation. Chris is the Senior Director of Substance Use Disorders and Recovery at the Clinton Foundation. If you'd like more information about the Clinton Foundation, go to clintonfoundation.org. And for more information on Color Me Healthy, please visit our website at chcb.net/podcast. You can also follow us on our Facebook page or on the Podbean mobile app. If you have any comments or show suggestions, you can email us at colormehealthy@chcb.net. For Color Me Healthy, I'm your host, Carl Shallowhorn. Be well.